who met with Material Service to tell them of that possibility. So they brought Material Service in. When Material Service learns of the possibility of picketing, they set up so-called Plan B to identify an alternative driller in the event that they needed to replace general drilling. David Olson, the vice president of Material Service, testified that Local 150 played no role in formulating Plan B and expressed no preference as to who should get the work if and when Material Service made a change. Also, on August 15th, Local 150 sent a list of 7 union contractors to all the quarry owners in Northwest Indiana, asking that they use those union contractors. We were promoting the use of union labor, which is something the labor laws allow us to do. FinDrill's name appeared on that list. We wanted the quarry to use a union driller. If it was general drilling, that was fine. If it was anybody else, that was fine as well. They ultimately went with FinDrill. So it makes no sense that the general drilling was able to thwart this conspiracy, because the company, Material Service, did what we ultimately wanted them to do, which was hire a union driller. With respect to the per se claim, the notion that this so-called or alleged conspiracy had the pernicious and predictable effects necessary to invoke the per se rule is also difficult to accept. They weren't excluded from the market. We've already gone over that. At the end of the day, the price for drilling did not change. It remained at $1.75 per foot. The only difference now was that a union driller was doing the drilling under a union contract. The price for drilling did not change. There was no agreement to begin with, but there was no effect, and certainly no anti-competitive effect, because the price didn't change. I want to touch briefly on the Section 303 claim and the district court's decision to dismiss that claim. Section 303 confers subject matter jurisdiction on federal courts to hear damage claims for violations of Section 8B4. The NLRB has exclusive primary jurisdiction to hear all other alleged labor law violations. In this case, General Drilling buttressed its Section 303 claims on a host of independent labor law violations. It is for this reason that the district court held this species of dispute is consigned by the federal statute to the administrative process under the NLRA, which has exclusive jurisdiction over it, to the exclusion of subject matter jurisdiction here.
Why doesn't it fall within 187B, which specifically confers a right of action in the district court for these sorts of injuries?
The statute confers subject matter jurisdiction to hear violations of Section 8B4. As I said, they alleged Section 8B4 violations but didn't put forth any evidence. So implicit in the district court's holding is the only evidence they put forth of labor law violations were these independent labor law violations that should have been brought to the NLRB. There was no evidence of unlawful conduct or unlawful intent. To make a violation under Section 8B4, it requires that dual showing, unlawful conduct and unlawful intent. And the Labor Board's decision in Moore Dry Dock sets up the framework for evaluating picketing in so-called common situs picket situations. That is, picketing that occurs on sites where there multiple employers are present. In this case, Local 150 complied with all the requirements of Moore Dry Dock. Compliance with Moore Dry Dock sets up a presumption of lawful activity that can only be rebutted by evidence of unlawful conduct or intent, and they presented no evidence of unlawful conduct or unlawful intent in this case. The threats in 1996 to general drilling were threats to a prime, which we can do. The record testimony in that case was sign a collective bargaining agreement or we'll picket you where you work in Indiana. These are subtle distinctions, but they're important distinctions. That was the record evidence.
So the district court's decision on this aspect of the case was really a merits decision and not a jurisdictional decision?
I think, like I said, Your Honor, the implicit in the court's holding that the species of this dispute, they called it a 303 action but tried to buttress that claim on a host of independent labor law violations. They didn't present evidence of an 8B4 violation, and it's for that reason that the district court properly dismissed the action. I see that my time is up, so if there's no other questions, I'll ask that this court affirm the district court's decision in its entirety.
Thank you. Mr. Kelly. With all due respect to counsel, I don't know that I have enough time to correct all of his misstatements of law and misstatements of fact. To begin with, standing, Errett, Judge Easterbrook's decision, had nothing to do with standing. It ruled on the non-statutory exemption under the antitrust law, saying that because Errett had entered into a collective bargaining agreement with the union, that this dispute arose out of and related to that bargaining agreement, and therefore under Brown, the labor, Brown versus National League of Football, the labor union was exempt. Second, with respect to the arguments on standing, basically what counsel wants this court to do is to get into a market approach under the rule of reason to determine standing. And that is not what the case law of this court says, and other case law we cited in our brief from the Third Circuit would note that there's a very thin line between those two things, but that antitrust standing, antitrust injury, as long as a competitor is being excluded from the right to compete, that competitor, that injury to the competitor of being excluded from the right to compete, is gives him antitrust standing. And again, the case law of this court says so. The Jewell case, Cifres versus Jewell, clear as a bell that a competitor has standing by attempting to be denied the right to compete.
The evidence is that your client was excluded from one quarry?
Three quarries, Your
Honor. Three material services, and who else?
Three material services, okay. Three quarries.
Three quarries run by the same
company,
operator.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, but it, not any other separate and independent.
No, they've sent letters. They haven't picketed otherwise yet, but being excluded from the right to compete for material services gives us standing.
Is there case law support for that proposition, that if you're excluded from one site, that
there is some Supreme Court cases about once, twice, doesn't make any difference. The question is being denied the freedom to compete, as it were. And by being denied the freedom to submit a bid to material services is sufficient. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Kelly, there's a preamble wording to the quote that you used from the Jewell case, is there not, where it says, when a plaintiff's injury is linked to the injury inflicted upon the market, such as when consumers pay higher prices because of market monopoly or when a competitor is forced out of the market?
Or yes, a competitor is forced out of the market. Those two things are stated in tangent.
Yeah.
If I left something out, I apologize. I didn't mean to do that.
The point being that the evidence does not support the proposition that your client has been forced out of the market, just forced out of one operator's quarries.
Right. That is correct. We've been forced out of one operator's quarries, which, under the decisions of this case law, as I would read them, that is sufficient. And that being that we have been denied the right to compete for the business of even one is being denied the right to compete by virtue of this conspiracy. Certainly the injury, the antitrust standing goes to the nature of the injury, not the quantum of the injury, I guess I would say. And that being forced out of one part of the market is sufficient under the Supreme Court's case law and under this court's case law as we've analyzed them. The one injury cases that they are citing, or the one competitor cases, are actually cases that arise under not standing issues, but under the per se, difference between per se and the rule of reason, if they are to be checked closely. That's not where it comes from.
Would you address the factual basis for your assertion that the picket was pretextual?
Yes, Your Honor. The factual basis for that is that all of Local 150's contracts with the quarry workers were separate in Illinois and separate in Indiana, and they had lower wage rates. We were paying equal to the laborers' rates who had unionized union quarry workers doing the drilling work, for instance. So there's a different wage rate as between the two parts of the country. For them to say that the Northern Illinois Producers Collective Bargaining Agreement established the area wage in Indiana, despite the fact that they did no work in Indiana, and despite the fact that when they were down in other parts of Indiana, like Indianapolis, they had lower wage rates, that doesn't make it so. The area wage that they claim was false. Northern Illinois Area Producers Agreement that had no work in the state of Indiana has not established the area wage for the state of Indiana. Secondly, Your Honor, in addition to that, their arguments of that they were doing it later, after the March 29th letter, for organizational purposes.
I'm sorry, doing what later?
That they were attempting to organize us subsequent to the March 29th letter, when they disclaimed that they were organizing us, still in the July 12th authorization, they from Local 150 to authorize the picket, they disclaimed in that that it was for organizational purposes. So for both of those reasons, we claim that it was pretextual, and we claim that there is evidence to support, or to go to the jury at least, as to whether it was pretextual or not. That's red.
Not, almost.
Almost red.
There, now it is.
I shouldn't have hesitated.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Scully. Thanks to all counsel, and the case is taken under